The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to another Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, your host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which helps people with cancer to understand and obtain integrative medicine. For this week's show, I'm in the heart of Totnes in Devon, arguably the alternative capital of Britain, and a forward-looking town much like others around the globe fulfilling similar roles, such as Byron Bay in Australia or Boulder in Colorado. I'm speaking to Dr. Stephen Hopwood, who works at the Arcturus Health Centre, right in the middle of town. Steve is a conventionally trained doctor who now exclusively uses complementary and alternative medicine methods to help his patients. Hi, Steve. Nice to have you on the show finally. I've been meaning to get you on here for quite a while. Nice to see you as well. It's been a while since we last met each other.
Great, yeah, nice to see you too.
Mm. So, I think you describe yourself as an integrative doctor. You've long had a particular interest in cancer and the way it's treated. Obviously, you're looking to offer resources that are outside of what's offered by conventional medicine. But from where you stand, what do you think in conventional medicine is working and what isn't working in terms of cancer?
Well, probably good to start by saying that although in a sense I view myself as an integrative doctor, I don't practice forms of medicine that require a license with the GMC. So
okay.
Although yeah. I am a doctor, I don't practice forms of medicine that require a license with the GMC. So I practice holistic medicine, really, that doesn't require a license.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't offer to treat cancer or to treat people for cancer.
No.
So that's not what I do either,
sure.
Basically. So, but what we do offer is to support people's health and well-being through natural means and mechanisms, basically, and that's the basic principle of the approach. One of my favourite Western medical doctors is Professor Robert Thomas.
One of my heroes.
On his website, it's probably a good place to start, it says, and I quote the professor, "It is now firmly established," and when the professor of oncology at Cambridge University says firmly established, we presume and trust that he means that, and I'm sure that he does, as it is. "It is now firmly established that a deficiency of micronutrients such as vitamins, essential minerals, fatty acids and antioxidant enzymes can lead to an imbalance in the immunity and an increase of chronic diseases, including cancer." It's also clear from published studies that an excess of vitamin minerals can also increase the risk of cancer as well as heart attacks and other diseases. So it's about the correct balance of micronutrients and optimising health through providing optimal amounts of physiological precursors, which is what he does. So that's what I do, but Western medicine, in some ways, chemotherapy, you know, statistically, does seem to have good effect in some particular cancers. But what I don't see happening with my patients, you know, when they come in, I don't see the NHS adopting the principles and the practices of one of their professors, you know, at Cambridge. They don't seek to optimize people's immunity, and that I think is a big shame. If you ask an NHS hospital consultant oncologist for a copy of the NHS immune system cultivation protocol, for example. You know, which one would, you know, looking at the professor's site there, thinking, right, well, you'd think, you know, print it off, let's have a look at it. There is no such thing. There is no protocol, and there are hundreds of protocols within the NHS for prescribing this, that, and the other, and doing the other, that, and this. But there is not one standardised, publicly acknowledged protocol that supports people in supporting their own immunity. And I think, you know, that is a gaping hole, really.
A tragedy could be described as in terms of people with cancer.
Yeah, and, you know, the professor's clearly making a statement that that's fundamental to the whole issue, and yet the NHS seems to have no handle on that process whatsoever, really. So, what we try and do to help people with their health and well-being is to support their immunity. If that, you know, translates in other ways, then that's good. But the aim is to optimise people's health and their ability to maintain homeostasis.
Right. Okay. So you would say that maybe on the cancer kill side, what they're doing is working, but they're not looking after the health of the body that has got to survive this whole ordeal and come out the other side.
Yeah, I think that's largely the case. And, you know, when the professor of oncology at Cambridge says that, you know, he thinks that it's, you know, it's immune deficiency that's likely to be at the root of the issue, and then the forms of treatment that they use and the forms of diagnosis in terms of CT scan, you know, clearly undermine the immune system. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to begin to sort of look at that mismatch of intent and you know, ask where the balancing processes come in.
Right. Okay, fair enough. So, looking outside of conventional medicine, there's lots of recent developments in supporting people with cancer. Things such as ketogenics, which are relatively new, really, but making quite a buzz, generally. So, what amongst the recent developments do you think has the most on offer for people with cancer?
Everybody's individual, and you know, different people need different things. But certainly, the principle of a ketogenic diet is looking to be very sensible. Seems to more and more support the understanding that sugar, you know, is what cancer feeds off, and if we can provide the body with fat instead, then the body would actually prefer to run on that. So if you can create a diet that's got a low glycemic index and supports keeping away from sugars and sugar derivatives, then that does seem to be this very sensible. And that whole understanding seems to have grown enormously in the last few years.
It does,
and,
yeah.
And the idea that, you know, not only sugars are bad for us, we've got a sugar tax now, finally, from the government.
Yep.
But, you know, whether that's a license for aspartame is another question.
All the horrors, really. That's right.
Yeah. But it is, you know, now becoming acknowledged that sugar's not in the best interest of our immunity. So the idea that, in a sense, everything is sugar is quite a good concept. It's just a question of how long it takes to turn into sugar.
Right.
So on the far left of the spectrum, you've got fats and proteins and complex carbohydrates. And on the far right, you've got refined carbohydrates, which turn very quickly into sugar. So shifting the diet away from carbs and refined carbs and towards complex carbs, fats and proteins, you know, seems to be a good way forward.
Yeah. It's it's very heartening to see a growing awareness about the fact that sugar's not so great, and the attention going away from the big scary fat. That seems to be a good move. Unfortunately, oncology seems to be one of the last strongholds of complete ignorance about any dangers of sugar with relation to cancer. I mean, it goes beyond ignorance to denial. But still, have you seen any signs of change there? Do you think that this is going to move anytime soon?
Well, there was an article on the front page of the Daily Mail once saying sugar causes cancer. So, you know, it sort of leaks through into the mainstream media, but doesn't seem to actually translate into, you know, the practice on the front line with the doctors. So
no, but it seems to be a separate. The whole issue of diet and nutrition in hospitals is dealt with completely separately to the rest of the world, though, isn't it? Because it's not the doctors themselves; they've got no nutritional training at all, so they just say no to everything, whatever it is, just to be on the safe side.
Yeah.
But the people who are actually trained in nutrition seem to be trained about 50 years ago, as far as I can tell, or the same training is going on, because it seems to be completely nothing to do with current science. Yeah. And, you know, they claim to be the people who have the specific information which must be used with cancer patients, and the nutritionists don't know anything about it. You know, they actually put this in statements on their websites and their documents that the hospital dietitians are the ones that know, and they encourage people to eat junk food, quite simply, when they got cancer, so they don't lose their weight, which is probably sounded good information about 1950, but now it looks like very bad information.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Okay, so the science around cancer is developing really fast now. I feel it's kind of accelerating, you know, the rate of discoveries, the rate of new evidence of things, probably faster than ever before. What do you think are the most promising and exciting recent developments in regard to cancer and the science around it? What's the thing that catches your interest most?
Well, certainly the movement, in a sense, towards working with the immune system,
right,
as you know, as a primary focus, that does seem to have, you know, begun to have occurred within,
yes,
the system, which is, you know, finally a great relief to see that,
mm-hmm,
approach happening. So that's excellent.
Yeah. And obviously that's something that complementary alternative medicine has been working with for decades. The attempts at the moment, of course, are to work with the immune system with drugs, because that's the business of medicine, is drugs. Do you think they're going to have some success with that?
Yeah, I'm sure they'll have some success,
mm,
with that approach. But as we know, any licensed pharmaceutical product, which is the vast majority of our medicines, are patented.
Yeah.
And if you patent something, you are only able to patent something that is basically what's called new to nature.
Right.
So you can patent a Dyson because it's never been seen before in the history of the universe.
Right.
But fortunately, you can't patent vitamin D or vitamin C.
Hmm.
So any natural substance cannot be patented and therefore can't be, in a sense, monopolised upon and used by the pharmaceutical industry to make profit. By definition, then, any pharmaceutical medicine is a substance that has never been seen before in the history of the universe, or some synthetic analogue thereof. So using substances that are new to nature and never been seen before as medicines doesn't seem to comply with my common sense, basically.
Right.
Our immune systems, as the professor has told us, have, you know, physiological precursors, and there's a massive array of physiological precursors that need to be in place in order to have an optimal immune system. And those physiological precursors have been around on the planet and in our physiologies.
Definitely not new to nature.
So there's a,
right,
you know, that watershed between those two things is, you know, a stark reality that, again, seems to be forever ignored, unfortunately. So almost by definition, if, you know, if Western medicine is using drugs and synthetic chemicals and new to nature chemicals to try and support our immune system and ignoring the reality of, you know, the known and abundant, you know, physiological precursors to correct immunological functioning, they're ignoring that whole spectrum of things that, you know, the body desperately needs to have in order, you know, in order to function. Then, you know, I just, again, logically don't think they're really going to be able to crack the nut, really.
Right. So success is almost bound to be limited. The other side of it being, well, as you say, first of all, it's something the body doesn't inherently recognise. But secondly, every single drug has a negative to it, which, of course, natural products don't necessarily have at all.
No.
They can be entirely positive. So all the time the body's having to deal with some negative. At the time you're trying to support the immune system, you're also knocking it in some way with a new to nature substance.
Yeah, which is bound to have side effects and knock-ons.
Right. And then you have another drug to deal with the side effects, and down you go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. So can you give us some idea, in order of importance, the top things that you'd encourage someone to look at and to address if they just got a diagnosis of cancer?
Attitude, I think, is the most important.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to have a positive attitude. Not to lull yourself into a false sense of security, but to maintain positivity, really, because that keeps your mind open, and then that really is the arena within which, you know, you can begin to support your return to optimal health. So,
okay,
you know, having that open-minded, positive attitude is fundamental.
Okay.
But then in terms of practicalities, yeah, diet, hydration, physiological pH, immune
just
system precursors.
Explain the physiological pH for the benefit of people who don't know.
Well, it's a bit like gardening. You know, if you ask a gardener whether the pH of the soil will affect the outcome of his horticulture, he'll probably, you know, won't be able to stop chuckling before answering, because
right,
he'll know that absolutely, you know, if the pH of your soil is way too acidic, then you can put fish and blood and bone meal and compost and manure in your soil and sing and dance all night, and you are not going to grow healthy vegetables if your pH is way too acidic.
Right.
And that's pretty much similar to our physiology. If you're trying to ask your physiology to perform an optimal function in an acid bath, where your pH is way too acidic and not optimal, then that will skew all of your physiological processes.
Mm. Yeah.
My son is fortunate enough to have a first in chemistry.
Okay.
And if you ask him whether the pH of an equation has any influence on its activity or outcome, again, he won't answer for laughing, because yes, of course.
Mm.
We all know that in chemistry the pH environment will affect how the chemical interact and all the rest of it. So
okay,
maintaining an optimal pH, you know, as in chemistry and as in gardening, and with our physiology, you know, creates an atmosphere in which optimal physiological functions can function optimally, basically. And most people, through stress and dehydration and acidic foods, sweet dairy, sugar, coffee, alcohol, you know, drive our acidity into a low pH and don't support optimal function. So that's one of the key principles to returning to homeostasis.
All right, and on with your list. Beyond that, is there anything else which...
Well, I'm a great fan of the professor, and I think absolutely giving the body the optimal amounts of immunological precursors,
mm-hmm,
so that the immune system has got the bits and pieces and environment that it needs to work properly is absolutely key. But as, again, with balance, it's not only about pulling in the good stuff and nourishing the body, but it's also about detoxification.
Right. Another whole subject.
And again, on the professor's site, he mentions glutathione peroxidase, which is the main mechanism by which the liver detoxifies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, one of the principles that I employ in supporting people with cancer is to employ a variety of means and mechanisms of allowing the liver to detoxify. So, yeah, that whole field of natural medicine, from, you know, taking amino acid precursors to glutathione conjugation is enormously helpful, but enemas, fasting, again, great for the immune system. But it's, yeah, vital to clear the body of the toxins and carcinogens, and in order to return to optimal health, you need to put the good stuff in and clear the bad stuff from the body, and then that gives it a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Exercise is important.
Right.
Diet, supplements, good sleep, hydration.
Right. So those are all areas to look at and just see that if you need to introduce change. Can we go back to number one? It's top of the list. I'd agree with you. It's the most important thing. How are you ever going to even start off in a good direction if you're depressed? Somebody arrives, sits down in front of you here. They've been told, okay, you've got 6 weeks to live. All their family are beginning to mourn their coming death already. Everybody thinks you've had it, basically, the person sitting there. Understandably, you're a bit down with this whole thing. You know? It's come out of nowhere, just hit you like a train. Be positive. You know, that doesn't work, does it? That doesn't do it. It's a good idea, but if you, what would you do to encourage somebody from that place to a place where they are actually looking forward and they're going for it and they're thinking, well, we don't know, but let's see what we can do, rather than giving up? Yeah. I mean, the fact they're sitting in front of you is probably a good start already.
Yes.
Because they're looking outside the box. But nonetheless, there you are. You've got to respond to this person who's a bit down, you know.
Well, a variety of ways. I mean, as you know, I've spent quite a lot of time attending conferences and filming various people.
Yeah.
And that's been quite helpful for my patients because I can send them to see videos by Professor Robert Thomas or Professor Pfeiffer from Switzerland.
Yeah.
I've got a good video of him, you know, integrative treatment in metastatic cancer is the title of his.
Okay.
So the Professor Pfeiffer from Switzerland, he believes quite strongly that even if people have got stage 4 metastatic cancer, then he still advocates the integrative approach in their treatment protocol. So he wouldn't do that if he hasn't seen it work. And
right.
You know, statistics are one thing. What the doctors say, you know, might well be occurring in the next 6 weeks is one perspective, but then it's very important to put that in context and say, well, you know, that may well be happening in 6 weeks' time, but you know, there's so many wonderful books out there. Radical Remissions, is that one of them?
Yeah.
You know, books like that.
That's a very inspiring book. It's a great one for lifting people out and showing them a new possibility that actually things could be different.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, because many people have been given that 6 weeks guillotine diagnosis and you know, and are still living today many years later.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a definitive thing.
No, but yeah, people do need to gain confidence, though, that it's not just pie in the sky and stories, that actually real-world people are surviving much longer than predicted, quite regularly, in fact.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's worth knowing. And of course, the statistics that are given to them are always statistics from within a certain box, which is called conventional medicine. And within the toolkit that they've got, they're probably not too far wrong. That's, you know, even within those, they will, there's going to be huge variance, and some people will live much longer for sure. But nonetheless, it's a limited toolbox, and you're actually pointing towards people who've actually looked outside that and have done a lot of different things, and in a way left no stone unturned in the pursuit of staying alive.
And definitely, you know, in all my patients, whatever I'm treating them for, it is, in a sense, the dedicated ones that that really put their intent behind doing the full spectrum of things that they need and ought and should and could be doing are the ones, you know, that do best, basically. And that's, you know, that's not surprising, really, not only in terms of what they do being more effective, but it's also a manifestation of their will and commitment and attitude that makes sure that their diet and their hydration and their sleep and their supplement, you know, all these things are actually in place, and that's the best way to go.
Of course, the will you mentioned there, the sort of psychological will to be alive, which people can quite easily lose when they're faced with, you know, the prospect of terrible treatment or whatever it is, or a very bad prognosis. That in itself is something that can develop and get stronger, and it does keep people alive, as we know. In the most extraordinarily bad circumstances, people survive and they really want to.
Yep.
Yeah. Right, so I'd like to talk a little bit about integrative medicine now. When Yes to Life began, we were working very much in an either-or environment. It was either conventional medicine or alternative medicine. But over the years, we've been pleased to introduce what we call starting the conversation, i.e. trying to get the warring factions to actually talk to each other, you know, just exactly like you might do in an apartheid situation. You've got to get these people who are seeing things exactly in black and white and have ridiculous views about each other to start to talk to each other, to realise that both sides are trying to help patients and both sides have things to offer them as well. And that from the patient's point of view, they are less interested in whether it happens to be conventional or alternative than they are in will it actually help me. So for them to combine forces is definitely for the benefit of the patients. So that's where we're supposed to be going at the moment. Government policy is patient-centred care, patient choice. We're not rushing headlong into it, but it is beginning to happen, just beginning. Anyway, you know, integrative medicine also is in its really in its infancy in this country. We're way behind some other places, but it's increasingly apparent to us at Yes to Life that many of the people who seem to do best are sitting in the middle in a way, just looking around and picking the best from everywhere. And they very often have done some of conventional medicine, but not all. And they've done a lot of other things at the same time, very often that have very good synergy. And they do incredibly well. And, you know, I could say I've seen many people who I feel didn't go nearly far enough towards embracing things outside of conventional medicine to give themselves the best chance. I've also seen people who wouldn't touch conventional medicine who they died needlessly. I think they could have stayed alive if they'd been more open-minded.
Absolutely.
So, you know, this middle ground seems to be something special in a way, this which, and that's what I would call integrative medicine.
Yeah.
So what are your views about integration?
Absolutely. No, to be honest, here in Totnes, I get a lot of people coming to me and they're very, you know, left of centre, you could say.
Right.
And to be honest, I spend a lot more time persuading people to have conventional medicine,
right,
rather than not to, basically.
Mm.
And I've got many examples of patients who I persuaded to have surgery and this, that and the other,
mm,
who are now doing extremely well, who I'm absolutely convinced if they hadn't had the surgery and had just insisted on chewing on turmeric all day, that they wouldn't be here,
right,
now.
Right.
And they now acknowledge that and are grateful for my support of them in actually,
right,
you know, engaging in the conventional process. So I'm certainly not you know, against that at all, because it works. And I think that is, as you're saying, it seems to be the best approach, really.
Yeah.
And my understanding of it is that a lot of the Western treatments are actually really good at killing off cancer cells,
exactly,
which is handy.
It is.
But again, if you listen to Professor Robert Thomas at Cambridge, and I've interviewed him myself, he's a wonderful man, but he says we've all got cancer. Every single living last person on the planet,
right,
you can find cancer cells in their body. So we've, right, all got cancer. So, you know, he says cancer cells are a normal, natural part of cell multiplication and division and replication.
And a few go wrong.
And, you know, if you've got 50 trillion cells in your body and every 10 years you get a new body and they're forever dividing and replicating and you're making new blood cells, you're doing making this, you know, then if your immune system doesn't work properly, then basically it's, you know, you can't tidy up after the creative process. You know,
right,
if you cook a really nice meal and don't wash up, and then next night cook a really nice meal and don't wash up,
yeah,
you can get away with it for about a week.
Yeah.
And then after that, things start to get a bit messy, really. So you do need this natural tidying up mechanism after the creative process that goes around and makes sure that these, and that is all about the immune system.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting to, in a way, to look at the different roles that the approaches that have come from conventional medicine and the approaches that have come from complementary and alternative medicine have within cancer care, because it's... as most people acknowledge, the NHS is absolutely the best at acute care. They're really good, you know, and they're world leaders in acute care, but absolute rubbish a lot of chronic care.
Yeah.
And cancer often has elements of both, and this is why I think integrative medicine can be so important. If you have a completely indolent cancer that's just, you know, rumbling along, complementary alternative medicine will probably keep it under control for years. But if it's got any kind of oomph behind it, the chances of stopping it completely with complementary alternative medicine are not that great, are they?
No, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because I agree.
Yeah, you actually need to knock it on the head a bit.
Yeah.
And you need to do that in a way that does the person the least damage.
Exactly.
So you need to, that's where the complementary alternative medicine can support the orthodox care in doing the least damage.
Yeah.
So you get lots of cell kill by whatever means it is.
Yeah.
And support that as best you can, and then you do all the other stuff
yeah.
to get the system back to where it should be in yeah. order that you don't develop cancer again.
Exactly. And exactly. That's the key point, because this is where we were going. Mm. You know, conventional medicine does work. We've all got cancer, but the point that we know quite well is that the vast majority of conventional treatments, although they're good at killing off cancer cells, they do tend to undermine the immune system.
Right.
And again, the NHS does not have an immune system cultivation protocol. Mm-hmm. So if you kill off all the cancer cells in your body, great, just what you want. But if in so doing, you've significantly undermined the immune system, which the professor tells us is often the reality of the underlying cause of the condition in the first place, then because we're all developing cancer cells normally and naturally, you can kill off every last living cancer cell in your body. You can wake up in the morning and you're going to have some more there. And if the treatment that they've given you to kill off the cancer cells has also undermined your immune system and exacerbated that beyond even what it was before, then you're going to find it really difficult to, you know, maintain your survival. Mm. So, yeah, this is where I feel integrative medicine can be great, because complementary medicine does understand what the body needs naturally, and it has inherent in it an understanding of the process of optimization.
Mm.
So this is another key principle, basically. I take blood tests for people, and the aim for me is to optimize people's levels. A normal range isn't a normal range, it's an average range. So 95% of sick people that go in to see their doctor and have a blood test create the normal range. So the blood lab will take all the results from the doctors, and 95% of the results that they receive will be translated into what is deemed to be the normal range.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be in the bottom 2.5% of society, or the bottom 2.5% of sick people that are going into the doctor, before you'll get any movement.
The alarm bells ring.
Yeah, anything in the normal range, they consider to be normal, and they're not even allowed through their system to prescribe something for somebody if they are within the normal range. And if they do so, then they run the risk of criticism and all the rest of it. I mean, you know, the normal range for B12, for example, on the NHS is 180 to 2,000.
Wow,
so
big range.
It is a big range.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's because there's a big range in society, you know.
But you would consider a healthy level to be?
Well, 1,800, if the range is 180 to 2,000, up the top end is, you know, is...
That's
where you want to be.
Yeah.
But again, if you look at what B12 actually does, it's, you know, it's an important precursor to all sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, and if you, but that's where there's a big difference. You know, if you come in at 300, the doctor's going to say you're normal and you don't need treatment. But you could be 1,800, which is 6 times 300. And then you'd have 6 times the physiological effect of B12 happening on your system.
Yeah, that concept of optimising your health just isn't really there.
No, and for vitamin D, which is known in bowel cancer, I've seen loads of people with bowel cancer. You know, they've had bowel cancer, they've had operations, they've had chemo, radiotherapy, all the rest of it. Nobody has checked their vitamin D. You know, they come in with a vitamin D in their boots, having had bowel cancer 5 years ago.
Right, and that's probably the best known, biggest single thing they could do straight away.
Yeah, you just stick it into you know, into Google. Does vitamin D deficiency have any relationship to bowel cancer? So, well, yeah, there's loads of epidemiological studies that have proved that.
Yeah.
It's common knowledge, but common knowledge and common sense and common practice don't seem to
converge.
No.
Okay, well, I'll just talk about something now which is probably behind a lot of what you just talked about, which is I want to just talk about functional medicine, because functional medicine has had its beginnings in the US more than 25 years ago. I think it's increasingly had an effect on many branches of healthcare, drawing the attention away from symptoms and towards the causes, and focusing on sophisticated methods of testing, just like you talked about, and using these as ways to establish the roots of the disease and the effectiveness of treatments,
yeah,
whether they're actually working or not. So it's the most fantastic thing that's happened with it recently is it's starting to inspire a new generation of GPs. I'm sure you're aware. This is amazing, and it's kind of helping to redefine their whole role in society as being trying to make people healthy rather than just doling out pills to deal with symptoms.
Yeah.
So I would just wanted to talk about how you feel there's no nutritionist really working now who doesn't have elements of functional medicine in their work. And just in your case, how do you see it relating to what you do?
It's fundamental, really.
Mm.
I rely heavily on blood tests, mm-hmm, to tell me what's going on. You know, you can take all sorts of clinical history, and you know that can allude to this or pertain to that. But until you know what somebody's vitamin D level is, or B12 level is, or T3 level is in reality, you're not really in a place where you can treat people.
Hmm.
You have to have that clear foundation, and then you can treat, and then you recheck again and make sure that what you've done has actually worked and that optimization, right, has been achieved. And that, you know, to me is good medicine.
Hmm.
And I'm delighted that, you know, it's on the up. It, you know, yeah, makes absolute logical sense. I mean, if I had at my disposal the full testing capacity of the NHS and their labs, it would be absolutely awesome. You know, you could go around optimizing people's zinc and omega-3 levels and,
right,
and all the rest of it. And that's what Professor Robert Thomas aims to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what I would very much like, you know, to be seen
all over the country. Every oncology
ward,
yeah.
Going to take... I mean, there's a very, very nice lady doctor here in Totnes who works in one of the local GP surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
I can send people to her and she'll do all the tests that I want without blinking an eye, and doesn't make, you know, the local community feel wrong for wanting to know, you know, what their blood results are, and, you know, doesn't deny them access to the information.
Mm.
But... you know, somebody will come back with a B12 of 300 and she'll say, oh, you know, that's fine, don't need to optimise that. And the patient will say to her, well, you know, it could be six times higher. Is that, do you think that would have any effect? Oh, no. You know, even a really, really nice, kind, sympathetic, positive GP, they still don't really have, you know, the full understanding of this principle of optimization. It's, you know, if you're in the range, even if it's down the bottom, that's fine. And I just, you know, can't see the sense in that. But here's functional medicine, I think, is where you can really...
Well, that's right. I think, you know, the GPs who've done that functional medicine training have entered a whole new world when it comes to realizing just how fundamental these things actually are and how much it does matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is my experience in talking to them. It's kind of opened their eyes to something which, frankly, it's given no importance whatsoever within their own training. So it's fair enough. You can understand why that should be so. The only thing that's given any importance are drugs.
Yeah. But, you know, why is that then? You know, the pharmaceutical industry started to make some money. Thought, oh, well, you know, we'll support medical schools. They could do with a bit of help. And then they move in and they say, well, you know, if we're giving you all this money, it might be good to have somebody on the board just to check that your curriculum's, you know, consistent with modern perspectives. And before you know what, you've got, pharmaceutical corruption controlling medical school curriculum. And,
mm-hmm,
and it's not surprising that they don't learn anything about functional medicine or optimization or immune system cultivation, because if the doctors knew and understood that, it would be really bad for business.
It would.
You know, that does unfortunately seem to take priority and precedent over optimizing the health of the nation. And, you know, we have a clear conflict of interest there. I mean, you can look at the Alliance for Natural Health website, Dr. Robert Kirk.
Yeah.
You know, the incidence of death in the United States from vitamins, minerals, and nutritional supplements is zero. One recorded death by the Poisons Institute.
Yeah.
And yet the recorded deaths due to pharmaceuticals and surgical mishaps and medical intervention is touching 250,000 people per annum.
Yeah.
In a country with a quarter of a million, in a country with 250 million. So was that 1% of the population?
Yeah.
Yeah? 1% of the population is killed by the pharmaceutical industry annually, and not one person dies from natural medicine.
That's
okay,
I know.
It's third only to cancer, heart disease, and then coming in a bronze medal place is the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, the amount of deaths in the United States due to terrorism, say for example, is obviously nowhere near that, and yet the budget given to fighting terrorism is it's beyond belief.
Yeah.
So again, we have conflict of interest and massive discrepancies that are subjected to institutional denial, which is a bit of a shame.
Well, I don't know how that's going to change, but it certainly needs to. So
slowly, I think.
Slowly, I think, is the way, yeah. So your, I think this Totnes Cancer Care Centre is your initiative, as far as I'm aware. Would you like to tell us what it is and what it does?
We've just got a small website where we put up videos of professors and doctors talking about different approaches to supporting people with cancer. We also have other sorts of information up there about diet and supplements and alkalization, and so just a sort of basic port of call for people.
Right, so free information.
Free information and support, really. Mm-hmm. So the public face of it isn't that large, really, but it's just it's just a port of call where people can come, but through that door, and they come into the clinic, and then we support them in optimizing their health and immunity through these complementary approaches, and do our very best to tread the middle line with that approach and support integrative treatment, really, because absolutely I do completely agree with you. It is more often than not possible to to give the people that need the support without employing both forms of medicine, really.
Right. So anyway, it's a supportive organisation, educational, basically.
Yeah, educational and supportive. Yeah, yeah. Just.
Okay, and I believe you came out with its splendid slogan, "Treating people, not cancer," which was a necessity and a direct response to the repressive 1939 Cancer Act.
Yeah.
80-year-old piece of legislation that purports to safeguard patients from quackery, but it's actually kind of been central to holding back progress in the whole field, anything to do with natural medicine whatsoever, or in fact anything outside of mainstream medicine. I know it's something you feel strongly about. Do you want to tell the short version of what it says and how it impacts on practitioners and suppliers today?
Yeah, well, from my understanding, it says basically, "Thou shalt not imply, impute, infer, insinuate, or otherwise suggest that you may be offering advice in connection with the treatment of or for cancer."
Hmm.
So even if you suggest or imply that you may be giving advice in connection with the treatment of or for cancer, then you are a criminal. And that does, make things quite difficult, really. Because in a world where science basically works from the presumption that we don't know everything, and that we have always yet more to learn, what we need to do in order to learn is build on our experience. And there are many people out there in the world having experiences of using various natural substances that appear to have some efficacy.
Cannabis oil
for one.
Yeah.
But and when people's experience demonstrates that there is efficacy or appears to be some efficacy, then it's not inappropriate to say, well, look, I think this might be helpful.
We have, after all, got a desperate situation on our hands with cancer.
We do. It's the number one killer and all the rest of it. So, it means that you cannot suggest, imply, or impute, or insinuate that you may be having, through cannabis oil. So, any new development, any new understanding, to try and get that you know, put forward and out there and tested, you know, it makes it very difficult. I got also in trouble because I used to run a small Sky TV channel called Paradigm Shift TV.
Mm-hmm.
For a few years, we had 20 to 30 hours of airtime on one of the backwater channels on
mm-hmm.
on Sky TV, and we broadcast a documentary called Cancer, the Forbidden Cures.
Mm.
And Ofcom came down on me like a ton of bricks.
Right.
This documentary was about a dozen different people over the years who had found things like, you know, cannabis oil or Essiac tea or, you know, a variety of things that they thought might well be efficacious. And it was their story of their attempt to get their substance that they experienced to be efficacious, properly recognised, properly tested, properly analysed to see if it really was, you know, mm-hmm. what it said on the tin. And without fail, every single last one of them was subject to criticism and derision and, you know, court cases. And none of them were actually saying, I have got the cure for cancer.
They just wanted to investigate it.
They just wanted to investigate it because mm-hmm. experience had shown that it appeared to have some efficacy. And
right.
and that, to me, is a natural way for science and medicine
something we're desperately in
to evolve. You know, you can't yeah. evolve things. And, you know, when you start to get an inkling that it might be helpful, then, you know, there's a process where that inkling, you know, is extrapolated and either confirmed or denied or whatever, and that's an appropriate, reasonable process of advancing understandings, you know, in medicine. And that Cancer Act, you know, puts a very large boot on that process, really.
In with this one disease, curiously.
Yeah. But to my mind, you know, the 1939 Cancer Act was brought in just at the time when they were starting to use large amounts of petrochemical, for, you know, chemicals on and introduce them into our food chain. And when they were really starting to ramp up the whole practice of using synthetic, new-to-nature chemicals, you know, as forms of medicine.
Hmm.
So just as they were introducing all the chemicals into our medicinal chain and all the chemicals into our food chain,
mm-hmm.
they put an act in place that prevents anybody from mentioning the fact that, you know, these things may have an influence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not great. It's a very negative force, the Cancer Act, in many ways, but I'm rather heartened by the fact that the description of what you do that you gave us at the beginning, actually everybody's realised that actually that's what they're engaged in, and that actually most of the people who are working in a field that is from the complementary alternative stable are actually promoting good health. They're not actually treating cancer.
No.
And so they don't have to talk about treating cancer at all. They're just supporting people who've got cancer. And this has enabled a door to be opened to helping people with cancer in a way that was previously, everyone is too scared to go anywhere near it. But now they realise it's possible. You just don't treat cancer. That's all there is to it.
Yep.
And you don't need to in order to help people with cancer either.
No.
Which is actually rather heartening, and it means that the...
And it's actually what you're doing in for real anyway.
No, so it's not making it up.
You're not even making it up or lying or being clever with words. It is actually what you're doing.
Know,
it's like, great.
It's so the Cancer Act is not actually anymore as repressive as it was at one time, which is a huge relief. And in many ways, even though it's not great, I kind of, personally, I feel like leaving it alone rather than seeing what they might come up with instead if they tried to change it, you know,
yeah.
which might be worse. So, anyway, that's where we are now.
Yeah, I must say, when I got, you know, done by Ofcom and
yeah.
GMC,
yeah.
all at the same time, trading standards and advertising standards,
yes,
that was
yeah.
the other.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had three investigations running at the same time. I actually found the trading standards people fantastic.
Mm.
Because they really helped me tread this line
and you had to get it right
and elucidate. Yeah, I was, you know, and they were helpful.
Mm.
I was
yeah.
scared of them, but they were really helpful, and they showed me this discrimination between making claims for treating people with or for cancer
yeah.
and treating people to support their health and well-being, and, you know, through natural mechanisms,
mm.
and delineating that discrimination was really helpful, and yeah. it was out of that that the treating people not cancer came basically. Yeah. It was a tricky situation at the time, but actually I was really grateful for it, and I still am, because it really taught me something that I didn't know, and it also taught me the way forward. And although traumatic, it was
difficult at the time, for sure.
Beneficial now.
All right, look, we're just about out of time. I just wanted to finish off with one thing to do. Here we are in the middle of Totnes.
Yep.
Totnes has actually led the way with quite a few ideas which have spread across the nation, even across the planet. I mean, an example being the Transition Town movement started here at Totnes. So do you think Totnes has got something important to offer in the field of cancer care?
Yes, I think it has, because of the plethora of natural and alternative practitioners here.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great understanding in the community, not just the practitioners, but the patients that they treat, you know, that understands these principles. Mm-hmm. And the more people that understand and practice these principles, and the more they become a normal, natural, integrated way of life, then the healthier we're all going to be. And it's, for me, it's not a question of waiting till you get cancer and then thinking, well, what am I going to do to work with this situation? You know, I think, you know, preventative medicine is, prevention is better than cure.
Yeah.
And if you can optimize your health naturally, then as the professor says, if you can support your immune system and not invoke chronic disease, then you're going to be in a much better situation. So in a way, Totnes is a living example of more and more people that are wanting to live in this natural and health optimizing way, and I do think in a way that's sort of leading the way for the rest of the country, in a sense.
Patient-centered care, they're well informed and they know what they want.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they're looking after themselves.
And they want blood tests and they want optimization. Yeah, and
that's good.
They don't want wheat, dairy, sugar, coffee and alcohol.
Right.
But, go to Swindon and try and get some lunch that isn't got wheat, dairy, sugar, coffee or alcohol in it. And
can be
and
tough.
You're on a can of beans, basically, but then that's got sugar in it. So,
Anyway, well, let's hope that Totnes is leading the way here once again. And the rest of the country wakes up to looking after themselves as well.
Mm.
Thanks very much, Steve.
You're very welcome.
Interesting to talk. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Robin. It's very nice to see
you. You'll find links to items mentioned during today's show on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Click the show logo on the homepage. And while you're there, take a look around to see what else Yes to Life offers. There's a wealth of resources there for people with cancer. If you think you might like to combine some exercise with support for the charity, then take a look at the Yes to Life 10K website, that's yestolife10k.org, and consider signing up for the run, which is in East London in October. Thanks very much for listening today. Please do join me again next week. Goodbye.